Good evening, and welcome once again to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM in San Francisco. I'm your host, Jeff Hayden. The Americans with Disabilities Act has been the law of the land for more than 30 years. This civil rights law prescribes discrimination against individuals with disabilities in areas open to the general public, such as work or school, or even the stores where you shop, or the bus on which you ride, so as to make sure that people who are differently abled are not deprived of opportunities available to everybody else. To understand the purpose of the ADA, imagine that you're at school, bound to a wheelchair, and find that the doorways don't allow you to enter the classroom. Or you're at work, and you have the abilities needed to do the job, but the cubicle's too small for you to enter. The principles for which the ADA was enacted, allowing the same access to either a job or perhaps a restaurant, a grocery store, an apartment building, these principles remain the law. Tonight's program centers around what happens when a business is not in compliance with the ADA. You drive to an important meeting, you arrive at the restaurant, but you can't get inside. You own a small business and get a notice where somebody informs you that your business has barriers to entry and they intend to file a complaint. What do you do? Give us a call at 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. That is if you're in the Bay Area. Or if you're outside the local dialing area, call us toll-free at 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. As always, our attorney guest cannot give you specific legal advice. We don't have all the salient facts of your case. We're happy to share the legal principles to help guide you in your decision-making. And you can call regarding any question regarding the ADA or how to determine if you're in compliance or where to go if you face a claim. You're not limited to exactly the point we may be in our conversation. So with us tonight to walk us through this complex area of law, attorney Catherine Kate Moore is the founder and owner of the Law Office of Catherine Moore in Redwood City. A top-rated trial attorney with more than 23 years of legal experience, Ms. Moore assists businesses, insurance providers, and self-insured entities with matters involving premises liability claims, product defect claims, ADA violations, and various tort claims. Along with representing the rights and interests of these entities in litigation and dispute resolution, she provides ongoing counsel and support to help them remain in compliance with applicable laws and regulations to avoid potential legal problems in the future. Fred Lustenberger has been a licensed contractor, a building inspector, an adjunct professor, and building official, currently the building inspection manager, building official at the County of San Mateo. He speaks tonight in his capacity as a CASP inspector, one of a very few individuals so certified in California. Mr. Lustenberger also has a private accessibility consultant he's been for over 12 years. As our guests do not necessarily, the views of our guests don't necessarily reflect the views of their employers or clients. They're speaking to you in their individual capacity and not on behalf of employers or clients. And with that, let me welcome you. Thank you for joining us. Kate, Fred, welcome.
Thank you. Good evening.
Thank you for having us.
You know, Fred, before we get too far, what is a CASP inspector?
He is a certified access specialist, a program that was enacted by the state of California about 13 or so years ago to help address many of the litigation and other complaints that were coming to the local courts, both federal and state, for accessibility compliance issues, people who can't get into businesses, for example. And what we do is go out either as part of a jurisdiction, a local building department, or as a private CASP. And our goal is to help business owners and others comply with the accessibility requirements as they pertain to the built environment, specifically Title II, Title III, and sometimes Title V of the ADA and other California laws that pertain to that. So we help in the very complex area of law translate into what they need to do to make their buildings comply to the greatest extent possible.
Before we went on the air just a few minutes ago, you held up a sign that seem to imply that somebody's been officially checked and is in compliance. Can you describe that roughly?
Yeah, the state act has a CASP. I send away to the state, the Department of the State's Architect, DSA. They have a compliance access department, and they send out, we pay for them, it's $10 a piece, and it's an actual certification. And I am authorized to complete it and either state that the building or facility meets accessible related compliance regulations or that it does not. And if it doesn't, I am required to give a list of those specific compliance items that don't. And it's a state certificate. Everyone has its own number, and it can only be issued by a certified access specialist. And business owners can display it prominently. Many do, but they are required to keep it on the premises, and it is to be viewable by members of the public if they're asked.
So basically what you do is enable people to be in compliance and help them to get back on track if they weren't.
Yeah, and the win-win there is, one, it helps with their own customers, either persons in a wheelchair or visually impaired, for example, do business with them. And it also helps protect them from the consequences of not being in compliance with various legal remedies that a potential plaintiff might have.
Let me ask a question to the both of you. You own a small business, we'll make it a restaurant, and somebody tells you that they tried to enter and they perceived some kind of a barrier to entry, or that maybe somebody in a wheelchair couldn't reach the counter, or somebody that was visually impaired couldn't read the menu. And they tell you you're not in compliance and that they intend to do something about it. What should you do? What's the first thing you should do? Kate, why don't I start with you?
Thank you. Well, what I would recommend if that happens to any business is that they immediately contact an attorney who's familiar with ADA claims and alleged violations. You know, there's various, once you've been sued, you're going down that path of litigation. The best way that you can avoid any of that is to have your property inspected prior to that time, bring it up into compliance, have that inspection sign that Fred was talking about earlier. But in the instance where you have someone who's complaining about a problem, if it's a lawsuit, yes, most certainly you need to be contacting your lawyer. And even if it's not a lawsuit, I would contact a lawyer and get some advice. You know, you got to get the property inspected, get it to a place where it is compliant with these various statutes.
Fred, do you agree or do you see it a little differently?
Oh, I concur, and I would also add that the law, at least here in California and working in the state courts, the federal courts don't necessarily have to abide by it. If you get a certified access specialist out to your site as soon as you can, then the law provides some relief as far as an automatic 90-day stay where a potential plaintiff has to give you a chance to fix this violation. And then the courts can vacate it if you do. So there are certain legal things that can protect you. And it's for a business owner who might be ignorant of the exact law. It allows him to get a person out that can help him. But they have to do this quickly. I would say that time is not on your side once somebody identifies something.
You know, Kate, a week ago, I announced that I wanted to do this program. I put it on the air that we were going to be doing this program. And almost immediately after, by sheer coincidence, there was a press conference out of San Francisco, followed by various news articles on the television, on the newspaper and the like, talking about this very topic. And it seems that the lawsuits and various claims have exploded exponentially in very recent times. What do you feel is going on here?
Well, there's a couple of things that are going on. We have, as you know, the Americans with Disabilities Act, which is a federal statute that was, it became law in around 1990. And this is protecting individuals from discrimination in all different areas of public life. That statute is not the only statute that is out there. In the state of California, we have the also the California Disabilities Act, which is collectively known as the UNRU Act. And the reason that I mentioned both of these is that while the federal statute, the remedy if you have a violation for ADA violations, the remedy essentially is that you, the property owner, the business owner, what have you, are responsible to pay for the attorney's fees and legal costs of the person who has sued you for that violation. And also injunctive relief, meaning essentially you have to fix it, fix whatever the barrier was. The statute in the state of California, however, goes beyond that. And in addition to having to pay for the attorney's fees of the person who has sued you, as well as the legal costs, the state of California statute goes a step further and provides for a financial incentive to the person who presumably was denied access, full and equal access to that property. And that what that means is that it's money damages. It's set by statute. So it can be up to three times what the actual damages are, but no less than $4,000 in damages to that individual. So you have competing interests here of, yes, the desire to make properties compliant that are accessible for disabled persons, but also the competing interest for small businesses that you've got. There's a monetary incentive here for people or a person to go out and to file as many claims as possible because there's money involved. So why do I think that there's a rise in litigation recently? Businesses are back open after COVID. Many of them are closed down, unable to operate whatsoever. Now that they're back open, now that they're having people come to their businesses, whether it's a restaurant or a bar or gas station or retail stores, they're open again. And so now you've got a lot of activity after a hiatus of the state of California being shut down for, you know, at least what, a month, a year's period of time.
If you read some of the articles that are coming out, it suggests that a fair number of these claims are coming from a very few people. Is that your experience as well?
Generally, yes, it is. There are a select group of individuals that are known to be serial litigants is a word that has been used to describe them, that pick a community and presumably present themselves to various businesses, identify a barrier, presumably a barrier to full accessibility for them. And you'll see a flood of lawsuits filed in that particular community. So it will be business, 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 business. Those individuals are generally also represented by one or two particular law firms. So again, you've got the financial incentive is not only for the person who's bringing the claim, the statutory damages, you know, one topic that comes to mind for me, knowing doing a lot of personal injury work and defensive personal injury work, that settlements in personal injury claims are, and I'm not a tax attorney and I'm not a CPA, let me just put that caveat out there, but settlements in personal injury claims are not considered income for tax purposes. How that works exactly for what is being paid out in statutory damages on ADA claims, I'm not exactly sure. And I don't know if businesses who are paying these settlements are also aware to send a 1099. But you've got, again, these attorney's fees that we were talking about, which is one of the elements that the person bringing the claim, let's call them the plaintiff, they're entitled to. And those attorney's fees are whatever the attorney who happens to be filing the lawsuit claims. So, for example, attorneys, as everybody knows, they bill at an hourly rate generally. Okay. So what hourly rate are people charging for different specialties? Well, generally that's something that the market is going to set. In this particular, these particular cases, there's no market forces that are dictating what is going to be charged for these individual lawyers based on their expertise. I've seen lawyers and know of lawyers with significantly less years of experience than myself, for example, and they're, to justify the fee is really difficult. My fee is less, but I have significantly more experience. But my point is that there's no one that's going to audit the attorney's fees that are being charged by the lawyer who is suing you, your client. No one to sit and look through the bill and say, you know, how come you're paying this much or charging me this much for this particular phone call? It is what it is. The more you fight it, the more it costs you. And so, you know, it's a catch 22 in this. There's no oversight built into the statute when you are awarding attorney's fees.
And Fred, did you have anything that you wanted to add to that?
Yeah, just to dovetail on to that, one of the challenges is that the enforcement mechanism, either by design or perhaps on accident, for ADA compliance, as far as the built environment is concerned, is it's either the Department of Justice, either federal or state, and they usually only get involved in large, you know, city issues, big corporations. They don't usually have the time or the manpower to deal with a small mom and pop shop. So it's either the DOJ, federal or state, the local building department. And in that case, we usually only get involved when there's a building permit that's been issued as a trigger mechanism. So when those two entities are really not there to go out and actually, you know, insist that people do this, the third compliance, and now what's become the most popular, is civil actions. And that's basically it. So if it's not civil actions being taken, and it's not some large, municipal interest or something like that, then the building department's not involved because it's not new work or remodel or so forth. That's it. That's the only way that the businesses are compelled to comply. So I would just add that.
So obviously there's a conflict between two entities or two interests. On the one hand, we have a private attorney general rule, so to speak, so that someone's out there getting businesses to comply. And on the other hand, the money that they're raking in comes out of people's ability to upgrade when they need to or run their business. So it's kind of a balance, and sometimes it seems like balance works good, and other times it's askew. Let me turn it over to Anne from Oakland. Anne, welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Hi. So nobody wants to sue a city, particularly a library, but I've been to lots of libraries around the Bay Area, and the restrooms do not appear to be compliant. Is there something having to do with the age of a building where they're exempt?
And that's actually a very good question that goes well beyond that, the question of the library. Just in general, we were talking about this before the show. I'll let you jump in, Fred, and explain about how an older building, when they have to comply and when they don't.
Yes, when you have an older building, say prior to the 1990s and certainly older, what the federal law requires, and again, they don't have to do anything under state building laws unless they take out a permit, then they have to do what is called path of travel upgrades. That's beyond here. But they have to do what is called reasonable accommodation. And there's usually about 21 or so things that are kind of specified in certain areas of federal law. And it's usually, you know, put a ramp in if you can, make the door openings wider. And if you have a building that was built circa, let's say, 1965, for example, and it hasn't been touched since it was opened, you know, no substantive work or remodel projects, then the only thing they're required to do is reasonable accommodation. And that might include making some alterations to the restrooms so that it will help get somebody in there if they're in a wheelchair, for example. That's about it. Now, a business that's a little bit more sophisticated might, to prevent a lawsuit, might go ahead and remodel the bathrooms anyway and get them made larger. But oftentimes, it's mostly has to do with the age of the building and if they had done any work or alterations in the building's history.
You know, Fred, I know that in some arenas, if I upgrade my home, for example, if I add to a certain number or renovate a certain number of square feet, I may have to bring it up to current code in that surrounding area. And a certain number more, I have to bring the whole thing up to code. So I know if I expand it a certain number of feet, I have to add fire sprinklers to the surrounding room. If I expand that even more so, maybe I have to put it through the whole house. Is this essentially the same thing where a building that might be grandfathered in otherwise, when they do remodeling or upgrades?
Once a permit is taken out to do certain types of work, most work, a few things are exempt, like changing out the furnaces or doing some electrical repair work. But if you do some a remodeling or an alteration project or an addition on a commercial building, we have in California what is known as the 20% rule. If you spend up to $185,000 or thereabouts, you're required to spend an additional up to 20% of that amount in various elements and features that will bring certain aspects of the building up to current law. And it usually has a list that prioritizes that, such as the entrance, the restrooms, parking, water fountains, so forth. And if you spend more than about $185,000 or $186,000, then you have to spend at least 20% additional on things that will make the building better comply. And they're called path of travel upgrades. And that's usually work that serves the area of new work or alteration, but can also be ancillary areas as well. And what I always recommend, just as a side note, there are certain things that experience shows become more target areas to some folks in the community that want to be, as was mentioned earlier, serial plaintiffs. Parking is one of them. Even though the code doesn't prioritize parking as much as, say, an entrance, parking for some reason seems to be a hot button where if the parking is not compliant or there's not an accessible parking place, or it's too steep, for example, that seems to generate, at least if you go on the DOJ website, the most litigation than just about any other single item.
One other question implicit in what Ann was asking is when she brought up the library, are government buildings, things that are perhaps a function of state government, treated differently than private businesses?
Yes, they are. They're under a different section of ADA. They're under Title II, and they're a government entity. And they had, back in the 90s, I think it was 1993, they all had to go through what's called a self-assessment program and identify all areas, not just with the buildings, but with their service delivery. So if they had like a bookmobile, for example, and they went out to different neighborhoods with books for children, they had to make sure that that service was fully compliant so that, you know, kids that might be in a wheelchair or visually impaired could get on the bus and look at it. So the cities, counties, local government, and state governments all had to go through this back in the 1990s, and they have to periodically assess the condition of what they're looking to make sure that everything that they're doing, both with their facilities and with their service delivery, meet current accessibility requirements.
And did we answer your questions okay?
That and more. Thank you so much.
Thank you for joining us in Your Legal Rights.
Bye.
You're listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM in San Francisco. Tonight, we're looking at the Americans with Disabilities Act. If you have questions about the act, give us a call at 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. You drive to an important meeting. You arrive at the restaurant but can't get inside. You own a small business and get a notice that somebody finds that you're not in compliance. What do you do? Give us a call with your questions. And again, our toll-free number is 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. You can call with any questions about tonight's topic, which is the ADA. You're not limited to where we are in our conversation. One of the things I'm going to, one of the things I wanted to ask you about is to tell me a little bit more about the California legislation and how it differs.
Is that a question for me, Jeff?
It's a perfect question for you.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it. As I alluded to before, briefly, the federal statute and the California statute are generally alike, except basically in one way. The federal statute requires the remedies. So if you find that there is a violation where a person with disabilities is denied access to a place of a public accommodation, which we've been talking about places of a public accommodation, for example, theaters, restaurants, bars, retail stores, etc. The remedy, meaning what happens if a violation of that statute is proven, is that the person who is bringing the claim, we'll call them the plaintiff, is entitled to recover their reasonable attorney's fees and legal costs, and the violations essentially need to be fixed.
So it basically adds pretty good costs to the equation. And perhaps skews the equation somewhat.
Well, both statutes, both the federal statute and the California statute. So I'm talking not only about a federal statute, but a state statute. They both provide that the individual, the plaintiff who brought the claim, would be entitled to recover reasonable attorney's fees and costs, and that the problem has to be fixed. The difference between the statutes is that the California statute allows for payment of money damages to the plaintiff that doesn't exist in the federal statute. That's the significant difference, and that's the difference that tends to motivate the serial filing of lawsuits, because there is really, it's kind of a no-lose situation. The person who brought the claim gets their attorney's fees paid for, their costs paid for, and they get a payout on it.
We'll return to that point in just a moment when we come back. You're listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM. We'll be back right after this.
Hi, I'm Eli Glassner, in for Tom Power. Matt Damon's new movie, Stillwater, is about an Oklahoma oil rig worker who travels to France to exonerate his daughter. Matt will explain what attracted him to the role and why his buddy Ben Affleck makes the best writing partner. That's coming up on Q from PRX.
Q from the CBC, just ahead for the 7 o'clock hour here on member-supported 91.7 FM and online at kalw.org. And at 8 o'clock, we'll have One Way Possible for a music interlude here on KALW San Francisco. Support for KALW is provided by the Bar Association of San Francisco. And if you live in San Francisco or Marin County, the Bar Association's lawyer referral service can arrange for you to meet with an attorney experienced in the area of law related to your situation. For the details, you can call 415-989-1616 or visit sfbar.org.
So, Kate, as you were explaining the difference between the federal law and the state law and some of the incentives it creates, let me throw a couple more variables into this equation for you to pick up. One of them is, in San Francisco, the DA's had a press release just last week where they announced that they were looking into a whole flood of letters claiming noncompliance that were sent into Chinatown. I'm not sure how they are proceeding, in what capacity, whether there's any possible liability there or not. The other is a more policy-driven question. Given where we are now, how do we get to a point where we preserve the ADA? We preserve these state acts that maintain accessibility, but stop some of these serial claimants?
Good question, Jeff, and I'm glad that you asked that one, because there are two competing interests going on here. It is important to maintain the integrity of the Americans with Disabilities Act and afford the protections that it does to persons with disabilities. The counter competing interest, however, is our small businesses in the state. The majority of the cases that I have personally been involved with in terms of defending ADA claims are the small businesses, the mom and pop businesses. They're not your major chains like a Costco or a Target or, you know, you name it. And I believe the reason for that is most of the large corporations have a team of lawyers that are continually making sure that their properties are compliant. They're, whenever they build a new facility, they know what they need to do. On the contrary, our small mom and pop businesses don't have that team of lawyers. And so the California legislature over the years has attempted to provide some safe harbors to those small businesses. For example, there is a way to minimize the statutory damages that I discussed earlier. If you, qualify as a small business, and there's different ways that that is defined, for example, if you have 25 or less employees over an average of the past 3 years and less than $3.5 million, of general revenue over the same period of time, and you are able to remedy the problems that are identified in the lawsuit within 30 days of being served with a complaint, well, then you have the opportunity to reduce those damages in half, so from $4,000 to $2,000. But $2,000 is still a lot of money for many small businesses, particularly when you also have to pay the attorney's fees for that other party and the cost. So, I mean, there has been that attempt over the years. There's also been some attempts successfully to have what is called a high frequency litigant. If someone is designated as a high frequency litigant, as we were talking about with these serial plaintiffs, the filing fee, which is the fee that a person has to pay to the court to be able to initiate a lawsuit, is higher, so added on another $1,000. And you can get a stay of the proceedings and immediately move to a settlement conference. But that only applies if the lawsuit is filed in state court. And so guess what? They're not filed in state court. They're filed in federal court. So those protections, while meaningful, don't really have, they don't have any teeth to them. So the financial incentive, and I don't mean to harp on this, but the award of statutory damages is the only piece that's different between the federal statute and the state statute. And so to continue with the integrity of protecting individuals with disabilities, I believe that the way to eliminate these serial lawsuits is to get rid of the statutory damages provision in there. It's a financial incentive that is driving up the cost of businesses for small businesses, and at the same time, not adding any additional protection for the persons that the ADA was designed to protect.
Fred, you have a small business that you want to protect. You want to keep your business in compliance and be a step ahead. Who can you talk to? Who do you call?
Well, if you want to be proactive, you certainly can. You can talk to your local building department. They're a good resource. They may not be able to do anything directly for you in the absence of you doing work there via building permit, but they certainly might point you in the right direction to where you can get the services of either a certified access specialist or perhaps an architect or both, and might actually come out to your building and tell you what areas of concern you have and where you can focus. One of the things I've seen over the years is business owners will put a lot of money into something that they think is going to be
from
a good
Berkeley?
Place to invest it, and it ends up being a low priority item when they could have put the same money or less into an area which is more likely to get them in hot water. And one other thing I might add, I've told a lot of people, both as a building official and as a private consultant, that if you meet certain requirements, I believe you're a small business, less than $1 million or to that degree of annual sales, there are tax credits, IRS tax credits, actually, where they can end up paying about half the cost, up to $15,000 of a particular accessibility barrier, what we call a barrier removal or repair. And a lot of people are surprised to know that. Their own accountants don't even know about it. So things like that, one to help you offset the cost of doing the improvement, and you can do it over time. And then I would also say that if somebody who's coming in and tells you that I have a problem getting in the door, if you can address that need as soon as possible and take it seriously, that's probably your best way forward to deal with it.
Let me turn it to Shimei from Berkeley. Welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Hello?
Hi, you're on the air. Welcome.
Hi, your name is...
Hi, this is Jeff Hayden. You're on the air with Your Legal Rights.
Just very quick. I've been trying for 3 months to get some help. And I think lawyers die every day like everybody else, right? Well, my attorney, I didn't even know she had died, but she was very, what's the word, unscrupulous, didn't help me at all. In fact, 6 months after we started here together, I had an accident, an auto accident in 2011. Anyway, and I was disabled, already was disabled, a disabled senior with 4 concussions, well, 3 concussions at the time, and I had 4 concussions at the accident. Anyway, she passed away, I didn't know it, 6 months ago. Now, and the settlement was in 2016, paid our shit, I heard from my former doctor, a chiropractor I'm also speech impaired, who also advocated for her to take my case, since another lawyer was also obstreperous and it was emailing him bad emails. So I got her, and I had a very bad feeling about her. Another attorney from the bar said, well, you know, you've already got 2 attorneys. If I take you, I won't make any money, and hung up on me. And so I was stuck with her. Anyway, she couldn't communicate with her. She was very difficult to email or phone. It was like pulling teeth to get any information. In fact, 6 months after she took the case, she said, well, how's the case going? She said, I'm not making any money from you. Go ahead and go to the Oakland Superior Court website and look it up yourself. Well, being disabled, injured, and with 4 concussions, I really couldn't understand any legal website. But anyway, she died. Settlement already done. Called the San Francisco Bar. What do you do? I mean, even Superior Court in Oakland said, well, we can help you. I said, I didn't know her address, didn't know her number. I didn't know her. Well, she died, so I couldn't call her. Didn't know her address. But I now have a little bit more information from Medi-Cal and someone low income. But what does one do? I mean, with the county, Superior Court says they can't help me. San Francisco Bar says they can't help me. Lawyers die all the time.
Start with the lawyer referral service. In the Alameda County Bar.
I tried.
And what did they tell you?
Oh, they referred me to, they said they couldn't help me.
What you want them to do is refer you to somebody that can research that information for you, that can help you find out the status of your case and the like. And the people that keep the records on lawyers and what's happening with them is primarily the state bar. And the state bar can help you with that angle on it.
I have all that information, but they still said they couldn't help me. I mean, I have the information of the case number. I have the information of the settlement.
But when you spoke to the state bar, was it before that you knew that the lawyer had passed? Because there is
a system
in place.
No, after.
And you told them that the lawyer died and may be sitting on the settlement money?
Well, it's in a bank somewhere. It's in her bank somewhere. Actually,
it probably
Medicare
is sitting.
Medicare recovery. This is what slow down. She waited 6 months after I cleared everything with Medicare recovery. Then they sent me another bill, and she said, "Oh, I'll pay that." And after she sent the check, she said, "Well, that's coming out of your settlement."
Yeah. Well, it probably would come out of your settlement, but the lawyers maintain.
But no. But the thing is, it was clear. She just wouldn't give me the settlement when it was clear. She said I can't be bothered, or I was too busy with something. Like, she would always make an excuse.
Okay, there's only so much that I can do from here.
I know.
And your answer lies at the state bar. And if you got the wrong person, call back again. But you want somebody that can help you. They maintain records. There's a system in place for attorneys that have passed away. They also are on top of the maintenance of what's called an IOLTA account, which is an account where
I-O-L-T-A. ILTA.
That's interest and lawyers trust accounts. If you have a settlement coming, she's supposed to keep that money in trust until it's given to you.
ILTA means?
Interest on lawyers trust account.
Interest of lawyers?
On lawyers trust accounts. In other words, hear me out. Pick up your pen for a moment. Stop writing.
Yeah.
This is an account that they're supposed to deposit settlement funds in until they disperse it. That includes paying people. It includes paying you. And they call it this because the interest on the account goes to the state bar and not to the attorney. And it's not considered their money until they pay themselves.
I don't understand when you say interest.
In other words, the account's in an interest-bearing account and the bar gets the interest. But an attorney always reports to the bar if they have this account. And that itself will tell you a lot, and it may lead you to where the money is sitting.
Well,
I'm sorry we couldn't be of more help.
I
understand, and I wish we could be of more help to you.
Yeah,
but we're really kind of off the topic that we're here for tonight.
Anyway, so I should give them that ILTA and keep
ask them about that information.
Pardon me?
You would ask them for that information that they maintain, and you should ask them. But again, call the lawyer and call the state bar and tell them your lawyer died. That's all you can do. Not the county, but the state.
I did. 5 times.
I don't know what else to tell you. That's really the only place to go.
Yeah, well.
I'm sorry we couldn't help you tonight, but thank you for joining us on your legal rights. You know, one of the things that I wanted to talk about before we go off the air, and we're getting kind of close to the end of the hour, one of the incentives is the unchecked legal fees, and that forces businesses often, especially small ones, to not fight because the fees can go up so much. And I know in other areas of civil rights law, sometimes somebody prevails in a very small amount, but there's a provision where they get paid attorney's fees based on the hours put in, and oftentimes the client and the attorney split the attorney's fees as part of the purse. Is that done here, do you know?
So that's a good question, Jeff. The attorneys, the settlements are, and when we're talking about we're basically talking about either the federal statute or the state statute. So let's take, for example, you're settling a claim for both. So there's going to be some injunctive relief, meaning you have to fix the problem. And then the property owner is going to pay some form of settlement. That amount is made up of the attorney's fees and costs by the other party, as well as the statutory damages. So it's going to be one lump sum. How that is divvied up is unknown. I mean, once that check is written, obviously we have rules of professional responsibility that there's no sharing of attorney's fees with non-attorneys. And the oversight of that is something that should possibly be looked into. I'd say follow the money, I guess, is the explanation there. But of course, from my perspective and from my client's perspective, we don't know how that money is being shared.
So I have a question for each of you. I'll start with you, Fred. If I'm looking to buy a business, the business is in a building that's like 100 years old. Do I really have to worry about retrofitting it? Does the fact that I'm buying this ongoing business change how it has to comply?
Well, you certainly should worry in some areas. And one practice I'm seeing more frequently these days is banks, before they will loan a prospective business owner any money to open up the business rather than the tenant, or to buy the building as an owner. Just like in a residential property, they need a termite clearance. They need a cash clearance, or the bank will not loan money. And the reason for that is ADA law, both the tenant, the owner, and in some cases, if it's within the statute of limitations, the builder, the architect firm, can all be share liability for an ADA issue. So it's very important for anyone looking to move a business in, particularly an older structure, that they get it looked at by a certified access specialist or an architect or other design professional, and see what their challenges are going to be. And then they might want to also talk to a lawyer and see what their risk management window is. So that's what I would recommend.
Obviously, we think of a business and we think about people's need to get inside. And one of the things that we've all come to learn is that there's many different types of disabilities. And getting inside may be only the first such problem. What are some of the other problems that we see, some of the other disabilities that may come into play?
Well, from a perspective of what you need to have for features and elements in the building, you need things for the visually impaired, for example, tactile warning mats. If you see those yellow bumps all over the place, that's what those are for. So somebody knows through feeling in their feet that they might step into a street and get run over. And if you don't have one there, it's not only an ADA potential violation, it could also be a life safety liability issue. Hearing impaired. If you have a conference room and you have a business, you have to provide assisted listening devices for someone so that they can partake. If you're going to run a playhouse, like where you show movies or live action theater, you have to have a certain percentage of the seats, not only with listening devices, but they have to have a clear view of the stage from somebody in a seated position. And then you have to provide companion seating for them so that they don't have to sit 30 feet away from the person they came with. If you want to go to a bar and enjoy an adult beverage, you can't. Another thing that's become an area of controversy in recent years, it's what's called highlighting, where you can't put the accessible seating around the corner of the bar out on the left side or whatever. If you have equivalent facilitation, if you have a view out a window in a restaurant, for example, everyone has to be able to have a certain percentage to be able to look at that. So you can't have highlighting where somebody who's in a wheelchair, for example, has to go sit someplace else and do that. So with very few exceptions, gas pumps is one where you're allowed to have somebody come out and pump the gas because that's a life safety concern. Most every other facet of modern life where commerce is involved, a person with disabilities has to have the opportunity to partake in it. That's kind of where we're at right now.
Speaking of where we're at right now, we're very close to the end of the hour, and I did want to give each of you about 2 minutes for any closing final thoughts that you had. Kate, did you want to jump in first?
Yes, thanks, Jeff. As we've been talking about these two statutes, I hope I'm making the point that the California statute needs to change. It's allowed, the way that it's written, it's allowed for certain individuals to abuse it as it has been written. My suggestions and things that I think might help to curtail some of these serial litigants, and at the same time, not only continue to protect people with disabilities, but also protect small businesses, is to have some changes to that statute, which requires getting a hold of your California legislature, then urge them to make some amendments. For example, one idea is that before you can file the lawsuit, that the business has to be notified about the potential violations and then have an opportunity to cure those defects within a certain period of time before you can file the lawsuit. That's one way. Another, as I have said earlier, is eliminating the statutory damages provision altogether. Of course, you know, this will take time and it takes people to reach out to their legislatures, but I really encourage your listeners and anyone who is a business owner that has something that's open to public accommodation. If you haven't faced this issue yet, more than likely you will. And from the ground roots up, the statute needs to change.
Fred, any last thoughts?
Yeah, I would just have two things in closing. One, for any business or prospective business owner, remember that compliance with the ADA, it is federal civil rights legislation. It is something that needs to be taken seriously. And secondly, it's easier, faster, and it's a lot less expensive to get a CASP, identify the problems, and fix them. It's easier to pay a contractor to fix whatever building issues you have than it is to hire an attorney and go to court and fight it. It's just the way that cost of doing business is, just like paying taxes and other things that you have to do. It just consider it a cost of doing business.
And like many things, you look the other way, it gets bigger. Take care of it when you can. You've been listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM in San Francisco. Tonight we've been discussing the Americans with Disabilities Act. We're asking that you please tune in next Wednesday night at our usual time of 6 o'clock as we're planning to take a look at the evolving laws relating to cannabis. Our show tonight has been produced by yours truly. Our guests tonight have been Redwood City Attorney Kate Moore and Certified Access Specialist Fred Lustenberger. And thank you to all of you for listening tonight, and especially a big thanks to our guests. And at the controls, Damian D. Minor. I'm Jeff Hayden. Good night and stay safe.
Support for KALW is provided by the Bar Association of San Francisco. And if you live in San Francisco or Marin County, the Bar Association's law referral service can arrange for you to meet with an attorney experienced in the area of law related to your situation. You can call 415-989-1616 or visit sfbar.org for more information.
Hey, it's Jay Boogie, and I can't wait to share some bedroom beats and dance floor treats with you. Get your weekend started right every Friday night from 10 to midnight on 91.7 FM. I'm part of the station's new weeknight music programming, KALW at 25th Street. And I'll be joined by a roster of Bay Area DJs who'll be spinning an eclectic mix right here on KALW, San Francisco, Bay Area.